Hello Pod, I'm Chris Hewitt and welcome to another episode of The Interviews, the show that gathers our chats with the cream of the cinematic crop. And in this episode, we've got three cracking directors talking about three very different films. Jon Favreau is the director of films like Iron Man 1 and 2, Elf, Chef, Cowboys and Aliens, Maid, The Jungle Book, and The Lion King. His last few years have been spent as co-creator, along with Dave Filoni, of The Mandalorian, the Disney Plus Star Wars show that introduced the world to the Mandalorian bounty hunter Din Djarin and his young apprentice, the cute, force-sensitive alien known as Grogu, or Baby Yoda, if you're not into the whole Grogu thing. After three seasons of the TV show, Favreau has taken his creations to the big screen with The Mandalorian and Grogu, and I sat down with him recently for a big old spoiler chat about the movie. That interview can be heard in full, along with nearly 2 hours of Team Empire's deep dive into the film over at our spoiler special feed, but right now you're going to hear roughly the first half of it. There are spoilers here, of course, so do tread carefully if you have not seen The Mandalorian and Grogu. Enjoy. Jon Favreau, director of The Mandalorian and Grogu, welcome to the Empire Podcast Spoiler Special.
Pleasure speaking to you again.
And likewise. How are you?
I'm great. I'm excited. So yeah. as we're sitting here, it's before the film comes out. So
yes.
People who are seeing this will have assumed, so this is, there's still the anticipation of how it's going to play, but I'm happy to talk about it.
How's it been for you going around the world on this tour? I mean, who's seen the film? Who's seen the 27 minutes?
A lot of people have seen. We did a big IMAX event where we played, I think, in like 100 theaters around the world.
Yeah.
And people saw 25 minutes. We don't usually do that with Star Wars, but
yeah.
We decided to do it and show people, especially because this was coming off. A lot of people know the TV show.
Yeah.
Wanted to show that there's a different scope and scale to this. And yeah. And we partnered with IMAX very early, so it was a nice thing for the relationship to give them something to present on May the 4th.
Absolutely. I love those aspect ratio changes.
Thank you. It's so much fun. I played it a little bit. I directed one episode of the series.
Yes.
Which is the first episode of the second season.
Yes.
And I played with even in that one with the crate dragon, I opened up to 185, to 16.9.
Uh-huh.
And it was a little cheeky, but it was fun. And I actually liked it. I like that aspect ratio. I do like a tall aspect ratio, but Star Wars so much is, I know when Greg Fraser and I were discussing the first season and the first episode.
Yeah.
I had wanted to go 16.9 for the show, and he was like, "No, Star Wars is 2.35. It's widescreen. It's scope, and we use scope." And because part of that was, how do we let people feel that they're seeing Star Wars on the small screen for when we started launched for streaming?
Yeah.
That was the challenge, and we started with the assumption nobody had seen anything. We also knew that we had the cloud cover of the Skywalker saga.
Yes.
Because JJ's movie was coming out at the same time that Disney Plus was launching. So we were kind of off to the side. We weren't the main focal point. So it gave us a lot of freedom to tell a smaller story with new characters. And even though the backdrop was very familiar to fans, it didn't assume that people knew anything about Star Wars. Of course, if you knew, there was a lot in there for you.
Mm-hmm.
And this new relationship with these characters formed for a lot of people. Some people, it was their first Star Wars. And so that was our challenge. And now we have the challenge of, how do you bring these characters to the big screen and differentiate it?
Yeah.
And you know, because I had written a fourth season. I was planning on doing a fourth season before there was a lot of stoppage of work because theaters were closed down, sets were closed down. We had a strike.
Actors and writers.
Yeah, actors and writers. I had written the fourth season before, thinking that maybe, but we didn't do it. And then when we came out of the strike, it had been almost seven years since there was a Star Wars film. Disney and Lucasfilm approached me about taking these characters to the big screen. It wasn't as simple as just, I have season four. Let's just, can't do that. Season four assumes you saw season one, two, and three and knew everything. A movie, if you're going and you may have seen the show, I want you to be able to bring somebody with you, maybe even somebody who wasn't old enough to see Star Wars 7 years ago. Who now they're like 12 years old now. I want them to feel about Star Wars the way I did when I first saw Star Wars in 77.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I want to invite new people in. And so we operated under the assumption that we did season one, episode one, which is, let's assume nobody knows these characters. Nobody's seen Star Wars before. Let's let this be something that they could be their first experience. But you got to put the fans first, and you got to make sure there's enough there about the overarching story and in the margins and about Star Wars that that the fans who gave you the opportunity to do what you're doing, that they're getting a lot out of it too. So that's the balancing act you have to do.
So is this a completely new story that you guys came up with for this movie, or is season four adapted in some way?
No, there were storylines and that are running through the course of everything leading through Ahsoka season two and into Dave Filoni's larger vision.
Yeah.
So you have to acknowledge the backdrop. So there were Imperial remnants.
Yeah.
Implied at the end of season three.
Yeah.
That becomes a starting point for what's about to coalesce into the larger Thrawn storyline. Mm-hmm. And so for here, we had identified people, but this was not the story we were going to tell. There were other characters. It was a different thing. It was a different thing that had a more, this is a 2-hour one-off adventure that was 8 episodes. That was weaving and incorporating other characters that are not in this that were speaking to the larger storyline.
Okay.
And so this is more like a James Bond, Indiana Jones.
Yeah.
You're catching this in the middle of a larger thing, but this is, you could watch this out of order with anything else and you'll enjoy.
So it's a conscious choice. There's a lot of Mandalorian lore in season three.
Yes.
I correct me if I'm wrong in this, John, because I've only seen the film once, but I don't even think we hear the words Din Djarin. In the movie.
No, you
so
don't.
These are all conscious choices that you're making to make it as accessible as you can.
Making it accessible isn't the goal of it. Telling the best story is the goal, but limiting yourself in a way that you have less clubs in your golf bag. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes.
You want deep cuts and you could have other characters threading in and out.
Uh-huh.
In a TV show, you love when characters, when I'm watching, Dunkin' Egg, Night of the Seven Kingdoms.
Yeah,
any allusions to what's happening with the families or the Game of Thrones or House of Dragons story? Like, I'm digging as a person who watched all of it.
Mm-hmm.
But that central driving story of those two characters are, mm-hmm. I think, a great inroad, and the scale of that mm-hmm. show. I connect with that. I like the ground level story. I like the hidden fortress. Be honest with you, New Hope.
Yeah.
New Hope, they don't know. You know, you meet the princess in both of those cases, and then you get some insight, or Darth Vader, or what's happening in the, right? But you're seeing it. I saw that movie as a kid through Luke Skywalker's eyes. I just knew those were bad guys. I wasn't clocking the significance of Alderaan or the Yavin or... I just knew this is what they had to do next. Han Solo was mm-hmm. out for himself, and mm-hmm. Chewbacca was tough and cool, but, you know, you don't want to cross him. You know, R2-D2 was awesome and cool, my favorite character. So I always like the ground level storytelling, but I appreciate it when it's set against a backdrop that if you did zoom out, there is a larger story taking place.
Absolutely.
And that's working with Dave Filoni. Allows me to concentrate as much as I want on the human scale story that I could really wrap my head around. And then he's a great partner, but also now, you know, he's running the show and he's always been keeping track of the broader Star Wars throw of things from, you know, having worked with George, seeing how the prequels line up with Clone Wars and Rebels and the original trilogy and into the sequels. Like he cares about all of Star Wars, and he's, I think, has that circumspect view that I value in our partnership, because he'll sometimes suggest something or adjust something, sometimes because it fits in the storyline. Sometimes they'll be like, you know, there was a mini rig INT-4 from the 80s that we could use in the back of the walker that would be cool. And I'll be, and I'll look it up. I'll be, that's ridiculous. I love it. Like the more ridiculous the toy, like the Kenner troop transport that we used in season, I think season one. So there's deep cut. Star Wars fans are so perceptive that you could speak to the storyline, but you could also speak to some, you know, peg warmer character that wasn't cool, like the Amon was just this basically, you know, I don't know that that character even moved. Is this in the background, Jabba's palace? And then we turn them into, you know, what's the full, could you make them cool and dynamic in a way that you imagine when you were playing with the figures when you were small?
We will talk about them in a second.
Okay.
But I want to talk some specifics. But before we get into stuff that happens in the movie, I want to talk about something that doesn't happen in the movie.
Okay.
So, John, I was very confident going into this film. Mm-hmm. In fact, I almost put my life savings on this down at the local bookmakers, but they didn't accept a bet for £1 that Grogu would say his first words in this film.
Okay.
That does not happen. So no, I would have lost my life savings, John.
It doesn't, yes.
Did you talk about that? Was that something you considered?
Yeah, we talked about it. You know, it's like where the thing with that character is he has so much runway because of how slowly he ages that you want to be really deliberate and decisive. Even in naming him, you have to, you know, people, once people feel connected to a character, if you remember when I first called him Grogu, there were a lot of opinions expressed, surprisingly, in Star Wars. But people, when they care about characters, you have to be very deliberate and decisive about what you adjust. He is growing. I think his growth rate and development rate is from a narrative perspective very helpful. Mm-hmm. The fact that now we've gone from him being vulnerable in a pram the first time he pulls back the blanket to working, you know, starting to using the Force to help rescue his father for the first time, but in a way that implies that there was some training, but there's not a lot of control.
Yeah.
And then maybe there's issues with how he's using the Force, that he's, you know, someone who's too young to have this much power, that you need training.
Yeah.
And then the time he spends with Luke.
Yeah.
You know, these are all things that have pulsed through the story in a way that we've laid a lot of good track, because now he's worked with, you know, you can't find many better teachers than Luke Skywalker if you're going to learn how to control the Force. It's implied that he at least recognizes the name Yoda and that he was there for Order 66. He was in the Jedi Temple. Mm-hmm. So there's a foundation of training. He's not just arbitrarily a Force user. He's somebody who has deep down training from a much younger age. And now he's been with Din Djarin, and he has been tasked by the Armorer to take him on adventures and complete his training as an adopted Mandalorian, as was Din Djarin. Hmm. So now you have this wonderful opportunity, because he has two great teachers. He has tremendous ability and he's a talent, and he is now walks both worlds.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can slowly flip the cards over, and within the context of what's happening in the larger galaxy, which is where my partnership with Filoni is super helpful. Because if I was in a vacuum, a very easy story to tell. But things have to play out in a certain way, and we have to account for that path as it weaves between other paths that
there's
are
there's got to be a time for the first word, and it wasn't.
So it's not just time. The words, it's also like, when is he, how is he activated? What is he doing?
Yeah.
How he's theoretically could live centuries. That overlaps a lot of other stories that are happening. So there are conversations that take place of how to make sure it all fits together and doesn't feel arbitrary. But from a character development perspective, you have a lot of things that he's doing. Speaking is only one of them. Mm. Also, whose voice do you use? What does he sound like?
Precisely.
These are things that we're you know, deciding and coming up with. But I find that taking your time with things, I don't like rushing through them. And no, he doesn't speak in this one.
Does he have Yoda syntax?
That's right. It's his first word. I read somewhere that the only thing I know is that I look forward to Yoda's first words, and they will follow his second words.
I like that.
So there's a whole conversation about that. Like, does Yoda speak in that inverted way? Because that's the way his teacher spoke. That's one thing. So there's a lot of conflicting views of, is that the way the species speaks, or is that the way that character speaks, and would he speak that way to honor his teacher? So there's a lot that we're thinking about.
On that note, John, it's been a pleasure.
Pleasure talking to you.
Thanks so much indeed.
Thank you.
All right, that was Jon Favreau, and The Mandalorian and Grogu is out in cinemas right now, folks. And if you want to hear our full Empire Podcast Mando spoiler special featuring me, Helen O'Hara, Ben Travis, and Amon Warman, it can be found at empirespoilerspecials.com, along with over 500 other spoiler specials, all for the price of a cup of coffee. Not out in cinemas right now is Joe Dante's Inner Space, the really fun sci-fi comedy in which Dennis Quaid's hotshot pilot is miniaturized and accidentally injected into the body of hapless grocery store clerk Martin Short. That's because it came out in 1987, but it has just been released on 4K UHD by those good folks at Arrow, so it was a perfect excuse to jump on the Zoom with Dante and talk about this movie and his memories of making it. Enjoy. We are delighted to be joined on the Empire Podcast by the director of Inner Space, Joe Dante. How are you, sir?
I'm good. I'm somewhat older than I was when I made Inner Space, but I'm still hanging in.
It's a strange anniversary to celebrate. I know it's coming out on 4K Blu-ray, but 39th anniversary, Joe. Which is... I know.
Usually they wait until 40.
But how do you feel looking back at this movie?
Well, I always liked this movie. I mean, it was a lot of fun to make, and it was challenging. But I've seldom had such a good time on the set as making this movie, and it was largely because of the cast. I mean, there were just a lot of people who were my friends already were in it. But working with Martin Short was just a joy. When you did the first take, you had no idea what the 10th take was going to be like. And he used to beg for more takes in the voice of Katharine Hepburn. Please, go, just one more take, please.
So would you find yourself letting him run and run and just do takes that you didn't need to see what he was doing next?
Well, I grew up with Roger Corman. I'm too disciplined to do takes that I don't need, but I did think that after we had gotten what we were supposed to get, it was always good to give him another one and to see where he was going to go. And I felt that with the other actors too, because it's all an interaction. It's not just one person. And, yeah. You know, he and Dennis they carry the movie, but they're only on screen together in one scene, and all the rest of the time they're talking to each other, and we managed to work out a way so that they could be on the set at the same time, so that instead of pre-recording and playing back, they could just interact with each other, and they could ad lib and stuff, and it made the relationship much better.
You know, watching the movie again, I was struck. You know, I obviously have my memories of it, but I was struck by how atypical it is, because it's Martin Short who's doing the action stuff. He's doing the action hero stuff. And it's the film's quote-unquote action hero, Tuck, who is tucked away inside Martin Short. So you have Dennis, for the most part, just in the pod, by himself. And I love that reversal, that subversion of the normal dynamic.
Well, I think that was sort of the point of the whole exercise. And I couldn't have had two better actors for those two parts, even though at one point one of the producers complained that we should have gotten two people who looked like Dennis Quaid, and why do we have this funny looking Martin Short guy?
Where did Martin Short come from, the idea of, because he had, at that point, obviously he had done SCTV, he had just done Three Amigos.
Yeah, I hadn't seen Three Amigos yet, but he'd done it because John Landis was a friend of mine, and I had seen him on SCTV, which I thought he was great on. He was an up and coming guy, and he made another picture called Cross My Heart, which may or may not have happened before or after this movie. I think it came out after this movie. But I think that there was some thought that this was going to be a star-making role for him, but unfortunately, because the movie wasn't, shall we say, a blockbuster at the box office, that didn't seem to happen.
Again, that is something that is really, really surprising to me, because I remember this movie coming out, and I remember it being a huge deal. I had the tie-in novelization, it was everywhere, and then I checked the box office, and it did respectably, but perhaps not as well as had been hoped at
the
time.
We had a fabulous preview where everybody was glad handing themselves and saying how brilliant they were to have made this movie. And then what they advertised it with a really bad piece of art, which was a giant thumb, and no indication that it was a comic whatsoever. And it, the phrase in the LA Times was, it crashed and burned, but when it came out, Interspace crashed and burned. It was not a successful picture. And however, every audience I ever saw really enjoyed it, but getting them into the theater, because, you know, Dennis and Marty were exactly huge stars. And so it wasn't a star making kind of a thing, but, word of mouth was pretty good. But what really happened was that it was one of the early pictures to be released on VHS and in Letterbox. I think it was the first Letterbox VHS. And it started to take off. And people started to think, oh, that must have been a big hit, that picture, because look how many people like it.
Yeah. So
it's kind of unfortunate to have to go back and say, well, you know, actually, it didn't make that much money.
That started at the beginning. Where were you when this came your way? Because I understand that you turned it down initially, maybe post Gremlins, almost immediately post Gremlins.
No, it was post Gremlins, and it was also post Explorers, which is okay. A picture I made before, which would have been a gigantic disaster commercially and critically, because they didn't let me finish it, so it was the rough cut essentially was released, and that's what people reviewed. But when that happened, I started. A friend of mine said to me, because Explorers is kind of a weird movie, said to me, you know, you got to stop making movies just for us. You got to make movies for a regular audience, you know? And I said, okay. So, this looked like it was going to be a mainstream kind of a movie. And Peter Guber came to me with this script, and I read it, and I said, Peter, people are going to laugh at this, because it was a serious movie. It was a serious spy movie with this plot. Mm-hmm. And I said, this is not going to work. I'm not going to do it. So I didn't do it. So then in the interim, Steven Spielberg became involved and brought in Jeff Malm, who was the writer of Indiana Jones, third Indiana Jones movie.
Yeah.
The Dead Zone. And Jeff turned it into a comedy. And he took the concept of the guy being shrunk and put into another guy. He said, well, what if Dean Martin was shrunk down, injected into Jerry Lewis? And I thought, okay, I that makes sense to me. And then I said, yeah, let's do it. And luckily, when you're working for Amblin, it means that you have the best, special effects, so the best everything. And it just makes it so much easier to make a movie, because you also have that layer of the Amblin people, you know, Frank Marshall and Kathy Kennedy and Steven Spielberg, between you and, quote, the studio. All the decisions that are made within filmmaking group as opposed to the people who run the place.
Yeah, I noticed that. I mean, I revisiting the movie, I was struck when I revisited it by how Joe Dante it is. I mean, you have your repertory company in there.
I was trying so hard to not be a Joe Dante. But by the time I was done with it, especially when we got to the ending where the villains are shrunk half size, I just figured, well, I guess there's nothing I can do. I said, these movies are just going to be weird, and they're going to be me, and that's all I can do. You know, I can't make other people's movies. I have to make my own.
Absolutely. We wouldn't have it any other way, quite frankly. But again, because you're buffeted in a way, you're insulated by Amblin and by Spielberg and Frank and Kathy. Was it easier to, for want of a better phrase, Dante it up?
Well, you're more comfortable, you know. When I was making Explorers for Paramount, I was on a very tight schedule, and I was doing a lot of weird stuff, and they didn't really understand it. So there wasn't a lot of support, you know. And even when we did Gremlins, the only reason it turned out to be as big a hit as it was because Steven Spielberg stood up for it, but the studio didn't understand it. They just didn't get it. They just thought the Gremlins were just disgusting. They blow their nose on the curtains, and like, we should not have so many Gremlins in this movie. And Steven said, well, we could cut them all out and call it People, but I don't think anybody's going to show up. So, yes, there was certainly a feeling of being able to be yourself and to get away with things. in this movie. But there were times we had to reshoot things. There were things that we felt didn't work, and we went back. But that was the great thing. You recovered if you did need to reshoot up, and that was part of the deal. You could do that. You have the freedom to do that.
You said at the beginning, right at the beginning, that it was a challenging movie. In what respect was it challenging?
Well, it's technically a very challenging movie, and you know the plot is, you try to make it seem as scientific as possible, but of course it's absurd. And we did have a scientific advisor to help us with all the inner body stuff and the idea of the experiment itself. But you know, you have to take something that's really ludicrous, and you have to try to make it believable. And that is, you have to pay attention. You can't just sort of slough things off and say, well, they won't notice that. No, you've got to pay attention to everything. And there's a lot of detail in this movie, and every level. There's detail in the casting. There's detail in art direction, and certainly in the special effects, which ILM, Janice Miro won an Academy Award for, which is as close to an Academy Award as I'll ever get. but it was the effects hold up incredibly well, and this is all pre CGI, yeah. And it was all done live. And I remember Roger Ebert thought there was medical footage in the movie. He thought when they're coursing through the blood, the blood veins and stuff. So they obviously used medical footage. I had to send him one of the little rubber platelets that we had been using to shoot through the plastic body, and say, this is what we really used. It's all fake.
Were you using sort of pioneering VFX techniques on this? Were you refining what had happened before in, say, Fantastic Voyage?
This picture, this picture was made essentially once before. It was made as Fantastic Voyage, which, interestingly, the two main producers had never heard of Fantastic Voyage. So they thought this was a brand new idea, but that picture was done in 1967 or something like that, and the effects that were available then we had come quite a ways from that, and so we were able to use completely different techniques, and also Fantastic Voyage was, I'm a big Richard Fleischer fan, but it's one of the few pictures that Richard Fleischer did that didn't land right for me. I didn't quite get the combination of making fun of it and trying to be serious. And so this is another case where you're making fun of something and you're trying to be serious. But I think I learned from the mistakes that I saw in Fantastic Voyage to try to do this a little differently.
What was your technique? What was your secret to doing that with Inner Space? In my opinion, I think one of the keys to the film succeeding is that there are real stakes. So you have the scientist, Ozzy, at the beginning being killed, and that brings a real emotional impact to the movie and makes the stakes real. So when Jack's being chased, we know that things can go horribly wrong.
That's true. And Ozzy, the scientist, is played by my usual DP, John Horror, who shot a lot of my other pictures, but didn't shoot this one because he's in it. And he's not an actor. I'm talking to Stephen about who should play this part. And I said, I should be the kind of scientist who, he's really absent-minded. And if he's holding a glass of water and you ask him what time it is, he turns it over looking for his watch. And I said, who does that? John Hora. And Stephen said, well, why don't you have him do it? Let's see if he can act. And sure enough, he was perfect for it. It was exactly what I envisioned, because it was him.
Casting Dennis Quaid. You said at the time he wasn't a big star.
Well, he was a leading man.
He was a leading star.
I mean, he was Paul Newman. No, it wasn't Tom Cruise. People don't go to the movie just because he's in it. But he was the perfect guy for it. Well, he's funny, and he has a certain arrogance in real life that he brought to the part to make this guy a sort of a, because when he's sashaying past the scientists to get into the pod, he's really strutting. He's quite full of himself. And then it's quite a comeuppance when he realizes that he's not inside a rabbit, he's inside a person.
The idea that Tuck is in the pod for pretty much the entire movie.
Yeah.
Did Dennis ever push back on that? Because I can imagine a certain type of leading man not wanting to do that.
No, I think he knew the job was dangerous when he took it. I mean, he read the script. He knew he was going to be stuck inside that capsule for a while. All that stuff was, we shot the Marty Short stuff first, and then we shot the Dennis stuff so we could play back the Marty Short stuff in his monitor. But they were always together. Even all the time we were up at ILM with shooting Dennis, Marty was there. You know, sometimes he wasn't on camera, but it was kind of a club, you know, and all the actors really were pretty committed to it. And, you know, and Meg Ryan, of course, this was like, I think the only picture she had done before this was Armed Dangerous. Stephen had seen her on a soap opera. Because Stephen used to watch soap operas all the time at this point, because he thought there were a lot of really interesting actors that were getting their starts on soap operas. And so he would have them taped, and he would just go through them. And I think that's where he saw her.
There are moments as well where it's just Tuck in the pod. So how did you and he navigate those sequences, those scenes?
Well, when he's in the pod, we had this slab of sort of body part that was, we called it the River of Looper, and it was outside his window, and it was on a roll. And so we would roll it to make it look like it was like shooting a car scene, but it was an inside body scene. And he also, a lot of stuff he has to do is to play to the TV, because he's watching Marty on the TV. And his reactions are, he knew he wasn't going to always be on camera. It would very often just cut to him during a scene to see what his reaction is to what's going on in the scene. Like the scene where Bob Picardo is playing Marty Short in Kevin McCarthy's greenhouse. That scene is not about Dennis. You have to have him in it because he's the one who has to respond to the fact that it isn't working. Editorially, I think it's just a very interesting movie because it's so much of fun is juxtaposing what's going on in the different locales.
That's a hell of a challenge for you, Joe.
Well, I told you it was challenging.
Yeah. And, you know, there are obviously moments as well later on where you're doing a lot of stuff with forced perspective, which tickled me immensely.
That was Dennis Muren, who, when the bad guys get turned small and have to get in this car chase and are in the backseat, we used a technique that was used in Darby O'Gill and Little People. It's called the Shuften process. And it involves putting the camera on a certain point where if you don't move it, it will fool itself into thinking that things in the far distance, which are bigger than the things in the front, will photograph as the same size, but then the people will photograph smaller. So everything that's coordinated between the people in the back seat and the people in the front seat, they're many, many, many feet apart, but in order to coalesce the movements, you have to rehearse it a lot. So it becomes like a ballet. Then every time somebody moves in the back seat, somebody moves in the front seat. And if at one point Meg Ryan slaps Fiona Lewis and knocks her into the back seat, but Fiona was like, you know, nowhere near her. And also there are puppets in that scene. There's some puppets that we use. There's a lot of different techniques.
There's another shot that I wanted to talk to you about. There's a car/truck chase in which Martin Short appears to do pretty much all of his own stunts. There's a shot where he is balancing on a moving car, and I can't for the life of me see any wires. Joe, what happened? Did you come close to killing Marty Short? What happened?
No, we did not kill Marty Short. And Marty's no dummy. He wouldn't have done it if he killed him.
But it strikes me like he's a great, you know, he's a great comedian. Maybe he was thinking, well, if Buster Keaton could do this, I could do this.
Sure, I think Buster Keaton definitely came to mind. Our stunt arranger was a guy named Glenn Randall, and he had this facility for doing that kind of thing. He worked on Raiders of the Lost Ark. And Marty is, when he's standing on the top of the windshield, he's obviously got a rod up his pants so that he can't fall. But then at another point, he has to fall off and into the seat And that's so he has to really do that. And also he's hanging from the truck and the motorcycle comes by. And that's really is Martin Short hanging from the truck. I mean, there are a couple of shots where it's a double, but for the most part, it's him because whenever doubles are used, that's when you don't see their face. And yes. that's why it's very important to get doubles who actually have the same hair as the person in doubling. Because in Westerns, it's so obvious when people are in fight scenes that aren't, you know, the same guys and they have different hair. It's like, wait a minute, that's not the same guy.
I'm just fascinated by Marty Short. We talked about, you know, what you had seen of his, and he had just done Three Amigos. That was his first movie. Did he audition for this? Was this something that did you see him in action?
I don't remember him auditioning. I think it was silly. We just Mike Fenn, who cast this picture, cast most of my pictures and was a great casting director. And he was really good at choosing or putting up people that he thought could play the part without having to come in. And like we didn't have scenes where Marty and Dennis came in and worked together, because why bother? They're hardly in the movie in one scene. So it was just basically we knew who he was, we knew what he could do, and he wanted to do it. And then of course, you know, since then his career has been, he's a very good dramatic act. I've seen him in a bunch of really good stuff where he's dramatic. And of course, his new show with Steve Martin, it's a wonderful program. I work with Steve too. And it's just so much fun watching the two of them work together.
The movie ends in a very open-ended way. Was there thought of a sequel?
I don't know that it was actually a thought of a sequel. I think it was like, well, it's a possibility. Maybe we could have a sequel, but that wasn't a plan. It wasn't like, let's make a whole bunch of Inner Space. I don't think that was on anybody's mind. But in fact, the ending does leave it open. It's an open ending. And considering the fact that Kevin and Fiona are in the suitcase, like in the car, I'm sure there's lots of possibilities for what could have happened.
On that note, Joe Dante, it's been an absolute pleasure. I'm going to let you go, sir.
Thanks, Chris.
Thanks for your time.
Okay, that was Joe Dante talking about Inner Space. Wonderful movie from a wonderful director. If you haven't seen it, check it out. If you have seen it before, it's time to check it out again. It's available now in limited edition 4K UHD in stores, both physical and online. Oh, and one size fits all. Last but not least, we walk down another memory lane with another director. 31 years ago, the English filmmaker Mike Figgis wrote and directed and composed a score for Leaving Las Vegas, a dark love story that garnered Oscar nominations for Figgis and his stars Elizabeth Shue and Nicolas Cage, with Cage ultimately winning Best Actor for his incredible portrayal of an alcoholic screenwriter determined to drink himself to death in Las Vegas. Now, the film has been released in remastered 4K UHD, which once again provided me with a perfect opportunity to jump on the Zoom with Figgis to do a deep dive into the movie. And it was a deep dive. We ended up speaking for nearly an hour about the film. And so what you're about to hear is an extended excerpt of that interview. Be warned, this is not a spoiler special interview per se, but we do get into plot details of this 3-decade-old movie from the off. And we also discuss certain aspects of the movie that some may find disturbing. So, forewarned is forearmed. But Figgis is on cracking, candid, chatty form here, so I hope you enjoy.
We are delighted to be joined on the Emperor podcast by the director of Leaving Las Vegas, Mike Figgis. How are you, sir?
I'm extremely well, Chris, and it's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, we're pretending, Mike, we haven't just spoken for an hour for the magazine, but we have.
Yeah.
But what a pleasure to talk to you about Leaving Las Vegas. And I know that this is a movie that you did revisit fairly recently. Mm. What was your big takeaway from that experience?
Well, what's happening in the last 6 months or a year or so is that, you know, not prompted by me, but three films have been digitally remastered, right? And it started with Internal Affairs. And then Leaving Las Vegas, then also Liebestraum, you know, and they've gone back to the negative and like frame by frame, they have, you know, actually not just restored, that would be the wrong word. They look better than they ever did before because of the technology now of free, you know, of digitizing and then, you know, balancing and all of that. So number one, from a visual point of view, it's just like quite stunning, you know. And you see the difference, say, between, let's say, Internal Affairs or Liebestraum 35mm, and then to see Leaving Las Vegas going back to Super 16 negative and seeing stuff that was in the negative that didn't necessarily come out in quite the same way in the transfer process of 16 to 35, which was not digital, you know. So, you know, the joy of just seeing, like, wow, you know, the realization that all this information, I know as a photographer, if you go and if you digitize an old negative, you find things that you never saw before, you know, because it retains all this information. So visually stunning, you know, that's number one. And then the experience of actually, I had the great fortune to see the film properly for the first time in Berlin with 500 people, you know, in a beautiful venue, the Akademie der Kunst. Audience predominantly young, you know, as in for them, a first time experience of seeing film. So it's like, okay, how is this going to play, you know? And also, I haven't seen the film properly like that. I've seen bits of it, you know, but I haven't seen it as a long piece of narrative. And I was kind of immensely moved by the film. I had forgotten how sad it is, how dark it is, how emotional it is. And then all the memories that came with that, which is, you know, the circumstance of making the film, the fact that the writer killed himself when we were about to make the film.
Mm.
Now, before I even met him, I was about to meet him.
Oh, wow. I didn't know you hadn't met him.
No. My friend Stuart had met him. So Stuart Reagan, who sadly died of, you know, like quite advanced cancer, but, you know, and was also already ill when I think he found the book in a secondhand bookstore in Santa Monica, loved it, gave me the book. He bought the rights, which were, you know, totally available. And then he gave it to me. And I carried around my bag for ages as a kind of favor, because it's like people give you books and, you know, they don't normally work, right? And then out of guilt, and because I really like Stuart, you know, Stuart was he ran an art gallery, nothing to do with the film business, right?
Stuart's in the film, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So finally, out of guilt, one weekend I read it. And I think I'd just done Mr. Jones and I was so beaten up that I think within like 15 pages, I went, this is incredible. It's so dark and so it's so well written. I have no idea how this, you know, I feel this can be a film, but reading it, it's a challenge. So it's all internal thoughts and, you know, it's what's going on in his head. But I said, yeah, to Stuart, yeah, I think it's really, really good. Let me have a crack at it, you know. So that was the genesis of it through Stuart. You know, and then watching the film as a finished thing all these years later, you know, so you are reminded at certain points, but the film is so engrossing that you're not distracted. But at the same time, in a much more wider sense, the bigger picture of the film is very much part of the experience for me of watching it, you know, the experience of shooting it, the experience, because it was the first film where I went, I want to shoot the next film myself.
Yeah.
I mean, so Declan's the DP, mm-hmm. Lovely DP, did a fantastic job. And he, bless him, allowed me to shoot the other camera, you know. I already owned a 16mm Arton camera, and which I believe was the camera that shot The Draftsman's Contract, you know.
Really?
Okay. I bought it secondhand, you know.
That's nice.
And so armed with these two lovely, beautiful cameras, the Artons, and French money rather than Hollywood money, you know, so it's a freedom of shooting for the first time how I wanted to make films, first time it happened. So the joy of that shoot, of that freedom and the creativity, and, you know, you don't realize that at the time, but by sheer luck, you have combined the right people, you know, you've got the right cast, sorted out the script, you know, finally, you know, which was a real challenge. And the location is containable. You've got a really great line producer who knows how to make low budget movies. So he's, you know, a fascist when you need him to be one, and a schedule that you had to stick to and all of that within those confines. And also a decision to make, don't carry lots of equipment, don't carry cranes, don't carry tracking. We're going to shoot this either handheld or on a, on a tripod or something like that, you know, for the most part, minimal lighting, you know, free lighting in Vegas, all that sort of stuff. So, you know, now you're watching it and then you're just like, and then you're aware of the fact that it's working at a certain point. People did not go for a pee, you know, it was silent. And then at the end, as soon as it finished and the first credits started to come up, they started clapping. And, you know, and then they clapped for a while and then they stopped and they just watched all the credits. And then when the credits finished, they started clapping again. And, you know, unfortunately, they hadn't set up a Q&A, which would have been perfect. But I couldn't, you know, it was really difficult to leave the cinema because people were just wanted to ask questions and, you know, talk about it. And I couldn't speak at first. I was actually, I'm a tough guy, but I was actually very emotional, you know.
What bit got you in particular? Just the crescendo of emotion at the end, Ben's death?
It's so sad.
Yeah.
So beautifully sad. I was like, beautiful sadness. Elizabeth Shue is incredible. I mean, Nick is phenomenal, you know, I mean, the two of them, you know, but wow, what a pairing, you know, that's like perfect, you know, all those elements. And the fact that, you know, I got to know Vivian Westwood, I'd made a documentary with her. She gave me all the clothes, you know, for Elizabeth, you know,
wow. And
just things like that, you know, just like, oh, this is how filmmaking can be. You know, it can be a joyous, emotional, wonderful experience. There's no guarantee.
Yeah, of course.
But when it works, it can be like that, you know. And you read about other directors talking about their films and they say the same thing.
And because you were an independent production, because you were running and gunning it in Vegas, and I know not always in Vegas, because you were backed by French money, not Hollywood money, I imagine you didn't have a lot of pressure brought to bear on things like the ending. You know, a movie about alcoholism tends, you know, the most studios would go, hey, you can't have the guy die at the end. You can't have him commit to this decision.
I mean, obviously, I acquired a new agent in the run-up to this and I was in Cannes with the Browning version. And they wanted me to do 3 days of press, like, you know, wall-to-wall press. And I said to them, if I can squeeze, I won't have lunch. If I can squeeze all the press into 2 days, can I use the third day? And they said, yes. So on the third day, Robert Newman, my new agent, who was incredible, and I, we did the circuit. I mean, the soft porn circuit, everything, you know, the low end of Cannes.
Mm.
And the final meeting was with the Cazes couple, who said yes, you know, literally the last thing. Prior to Cannes, we'd gone to everybody, Fox Searchlight, all the obvious places, you know, Weinstein, and they'd all said, no, this is too dark, too dark. The same in post-production, when I started screening the film, they all said, it's really good, but it's too dark, too dark, too dark, until John Kelly saw it, and he said, I love it. I'll take it. It just taken over MGM. So again, you can never underplay the hand of fate, you know, because there's so many things could go wrong, but for some reason at the last minute, everything clicked, you know? So a part of that is that it was a charmed film, you know?
Well, that's fascinating to me because, you know, watching the film again, it is really interesting how the movie, it never sits in judgment. It never sits in judgment of Ben. It never sits in judgment of Sarah. Yeah. It's focused a lot more on Sarah than I remembered as well. Yeah. I hadn't seen it in a number of years. Can you talk about that? I mean, that sort of freedom to not sit in judgment of these characters and the choices they make.
Well, you could choose to kind of just say it's non-judgmental.
Mm.
But in the script, in the book, and I no longer know what I wrote or what was in the book because, you know, I Xeroxed the book and I made these piles, and the pile that was filmic was very small. And that was my sequence. And I started to write connecting scenes that didn't exist in the book. And then I started to go back into the book and go, oh, actually, I could take that. That would work there. I could incorporate that into this and so on. You know, so I found enough looking at the film this time. Although it's non-judgmental, there are attempts, humanistic attempts. She does say to him, I want you to see a doctor. And that finishes their relationship at that moment. And then he says, maybe I should follow you around and see what it's like to, you know, have sex with you. She says, anytime, you know, just say the word, you know. So, and then he does become judgmental. He does this horrible scene where he gives her the earring.
Yeah.
And he says, you'll feel it as your face is being pushed into the pillow by one of the brothers, you know. And it's horrible, you know. And then charming moment where Bob Rafelson sort of says, yes. Maybe you shouldn't. Maybe she seemed whatever, you know. And it's a humanizing thing. So there is this, you know, it's very important if you're writing something like this that you don't lose sight of the fact that human feelings do come in at a certain point. She just doesn't want him to die, you know. And at a certain point, he's not so comfortable, as he says, with the idea of her going off as a prostitute every night, you know. He's jealous, you know. He's not comfortable with it, despite his, you know, apparent, you know, like total acceptance. So those moments then I think are vital to the balance of the film, because it's not just, you know, we're just going to go in this direction of non-judgmentalism, you know.
And Sarah is so crucial to the film as well, in that she's basically our way into seeing Ben, because the audience doesn't want him to die either. And he can at times, Mike, be a difficult watch in the film. And I think it's really, really important that we see that Sarah does connect to him and brings out moments of levity and moments of lightness and kindness in him as well.
Yeah. And this is an important story now, because, you know, I worked really hard on the script. I did 3 drafts of probably over like 2 years or something like that. I thought I'd nailed it, right? We got the money. We were in pre-production. And I woke up one morning just like, oh my God, there's something missing from the script. You know, at the end of the day, I read the script again. He's a drunk. He's not very nice. He's a pain in the ass. I've known alcoholics, and they're not fun to be with, right? Why would she fall in love with him? And then I went back into the book and I found all these streams of consciousness from her internal thoughts about how she loved him. And she was like, found herself looking for him again. And I thought, I've got to find a way of getting that into the film. So I went to the producer, Lila Cazares, and I said, thank God. I woke up this morning and I realized something really important. And I told her, we've got to put this in. And she said, no. She said, no, I signed off on the script. I'm happy with the script. I don't want anything else. And she refused. And she was a producer, right? So I thought, okay, I've got to be really clever now. So I cheated. And so we did a camera test before we were shooting, a couple of days before we were shooting. She dressed up in her Vivian Westwood stuff and all of that. And I said to her quietly, so Elizabeth, we're going to do some improvisation. You're in therapy. I'm going to be your therapist. Here are the pages from the book. Don't memorize them. Just read them, absorb them. And I'm going to ask you some questions, right? Very influenced by the film Clute. Make no bones about it, you know. And so in pre-production, in this camera test, we set up the shot, dressed it a little bit, some flowers or whatever, and made a little therapy room, and didn't tell Lila. When she found out, she was furious. And to the very end, I struggled with getting it into the film because she resisted to the final moment, you know. But I think if I hadn't done that, the film wouldn't have worked, because she allows the audience to like him.
Yes.
And that's the genius of what she does, you know.
Oh my God, that's amazing. Because I was going to ask about the therapy scenes and about who her therapist was and who she was looking at, because we never see. She was looking at you the entire time.
And I had to keep, like, you know, because I talk. Don't talk. You know, just ask the question and shut up. Don't say, or anything, you know.
So it was a very last minute that you were putting these scenes into the film, and Yeah. Either the producer was just going, this isn't working, well, or did she, once she saw it, she realized, okay, this has to go in?
Not quite. No, I had to fight, you know. She also didn't like the music at all, and she wanted to replace the music at the end.
Including the Sting songs? Or?
Yeah, she hated the Sting songs, you know. So I did a really, again, this is a, like, this is a joke, but it's true. So we had this thing. I had learned my lesson with people by now, with Ridley and with various people, right? Don't argue, right? All the time. So we had this conversation. I said, why don't you like the music? It's not just me. She said, my mother doesn't like it either. She doesn't like Sting. And I went, but, you know, he's given us like $1 million worth of music for nothing. We have no budget for music, you know, and it's just still hell under point. So I said, well, you know, let's think about it. I'll call you back. So I kind of like, calm down. Strategy. So I rang her back and I said, look, I hear your point, you know, it's a personal thing. So I've come up with a better idea. So I said, when I had my own theater company, I did this opera in German. It was all about death and everything. And all the songs are in German, but they're kind of perfect for this film, and I think we should use those songs, you know, Ich wein um meine Mutter, you know, Unendlich Schwarzhole, you know, it's a really dark, you know, and I said, perfect for the film. And she said, well, but who would sing them? I said, oh, I can sing them, you know. I may be making this up, but she sort of said, I'll call you back. She called me back and she said, we're going to go with Sting. And I went, I don't know. I'm kind of insulted, Leela, you know, but I dodged another bullet, right? You know, it's like it was charmed, but there was a kind of certain specific kind of charm to the.
Oh my God, that's amazing! Because those Sting songs and the score which you wrote is so, again, so important to the film and to the feeling of the film, and again watching it again, I was struck by, yes, how dark and bleak the last half hour is or so. But the Sting songs have this wistful quality, which is really interesting. And you have this almost, it's not quite this, of course, but almost rom-com-y nature to the early meetings between Ben and Sarah. They have a meet-cute, for God's sake, where he runs her over in the car. Mm. All of that is so important. Yeah. The lightness of the first hour or so of the movie is so important.
Plus, you know, I'm like a massive, you know, we could talk for hours about music, but I was thinking the other day, what's wrong with music now is that, you know, ever since, you know, everybody decided you don't need to do a chord change, you can repeat the same phrase for 400 times and that's a song, right? Yeah. And I was thinking, oh, what a shame that they're missing out on the Great American Songbook style of writing, which is actually genius. It's like contemporary opera. And you analyze the words of Angel Eyes, mm-hmm. or you analyze My One and Only Love or Lonesome Old Town, and they are narrative. This is operatic narrative. The words are amazing. And I'm such a huge fan of that period of songwriting, you know. So the end of that story is, so MGM show interest in buying the film, right? And they're in London, and they say, let's have lunch. So we're going to have lunch at somewhere like, you know, the Savoy or somewhere really fancy, right? And it's Frank Mancuso Sr., so, you know, back from the days of Paramount. But with him is the new head of the studio, John Kelly. And Robert Newman rings me up, and he says, here's what you should know about John Kelly. He's really quite a character, you know. He retired from the film business. He's come back to save MGM. He's a really interesting guy. And I'm sitting next to John Kelly. We start talking, and I quickly discover he's an ex-jazz musician, right? He's a bass player back in the day, right? He was in New York, and he was really good friends with Charlie Parker's widow, Chan Parker. So we start talking about, and he loves this music, right? So we just blah, 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 blah about music, about jazz. And then I say to him, look, I've got a funny question. I said, my favorite drummer of all time, no one's ever heard of, is a guy called Dave Tough. You know, he's the drummer's drummer. He's Charlie Watts' favorite drummer, right?
Wow. Yeah.
And he is he's the guy that made the transition from, let's say, Dixieland, traditional jazz into modern jazz as a drummer. He's unsung, but drummers know who he is. Mm. John Kelly sort of tears up and he goes, he was my godfather.
Get out of town.
Yeah. He said, I've got his musician's union card, you know. And I went, good God, you know. And so we bonded. And at a certain point, I remember Mancuso Sr. saying, you know, John, we should go. We have this other appointment. He goes, I'm talking to Mike, you know. So he bought the film, right? So Lila Cazares then rings him up. Now MGM have got distribution in America. And she says, John, we need to have a talk about the music because I don't think the music's right. And now Mike's got vinyl cut, but you're the distributor. So if you put pressure on him and say, we've got to change the music, in other words, do a Harvey, you know, he's going to have to give in. And he said, Lila, one of the reasons I bought the movie is because I love the score so much and I wouldn't change a note, right? So again, a fairy godmother, you know, and I didn't find this out till a year or so later when we became friends, because I then, you know, got a deal at MGM and at Sony through John Kelly, you know. But it was John Kelly who just said, no, I'm not going to change it.
Mike Figgis, has been an absolute pleasure. Thanks so much for your time.
Chris, been a pleasure too. Thank you.
All right, that was Mike Figgis talking about Leaving Las Vegas, which is available right now on 4K UHD, again, in all physical and online stores. And the full Mike Figgis interview can also be found over on our Spoiler Special feed and is well worth your time. Again, the URL, empirespoilerspecials.com. And that is it for this bumper episode of The Interviews. Hope you enjoyed it. Another one will be hurtling into your feeds very, very soon. So keep an eye out for that. In the meantime, thank you for listening. See you next time. Bye-bye.